How might last night's elections affect our economy?
And our national debt?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Bill Radke. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Wednesday, September 15th. There have just been a few Tea Party victories, but they may send Congress a message when it comes to cutting the budget deficit.
Also today, Congress begins hearings into the way China is handling its currency. But first,
let's say hello to Diane Lim Rogers. She is chief economist at the Concord Coalition, a nonpartisan group dedicated to a balanced budget. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So the Tea Party got another victory last night against a moderate Republican in Delaware. Overall, how does the voting affect your top priority, a balanced federal budget?
Well, I actually think it's bad news for a couple reasons. I think, first of all, the pool of moderate members of Congress seems to be rapidly dwindling. And, of course, we need people in the center to work on bipartisan policies that would actually achieve some fiscal discipline, because that's what it takes, is some balance on both sides, some cuts in spending and some increases in taxes. I also think that the Tea Party in particular, their message has been primarily low taxes. They also argue that they're for a low deficit. But unfortunately, they don't really seem to be proposing spending side policies that would actually do much to help that equation.
Well, I think the argument is that cutting taxes would force politicians to find spending cuts, and that tax cuts are exactly what the economy needs right now. What do you think?
Well, first of all, we've experienced most of the tax cuts we were contemplating continuing over the past decade in the form of the 2001 and 2003 tax cuts. It didn't work to starve the beast over the past 10 years, so I don't know why it should affect, you know, it should work going forward when our spending needs are going to just grow.
Okay. Diane Lim Rogers, that's our time, chief economist at the Concord Coalition, and she blogs at economistmom.com. Thank you, Diane.
Okay, thanks, Bill.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, September 15th. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. The House Ways and Means Committee begins today a couple of hearings on China's currency, the yuan. Critics charge the currency is undervalued, and that gives it an unfair trade advantage. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is with us in Washington with some highlights. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning.
So what can Congress do about this?
Well, some members of Congress want to pass a law that would force China to let its currency rise in value. And they say China has devalued its currency, the yuan. And that gives Chinese exporters an unfair advantage because their products are cheaper than U.S. products, because the dollar is worth more than the yuan.
All right, so the U.S. has tried to pressure China for years on this, right, Nancy? Have we made any progress?
Yeah, that's right. We haven't made a heck of a lot of progress. Last spring, when the Obama administration considered labeling China a currency manipulator, China actually agreed to loosen the yuan's peg to the dollar. And the yuan did rise a tiny bit against the dollar. But some analysts say China is just trying to throw Congress a bone. Peter Morici is an economist at the University of Maryland.
China's letting its currency rise a bit to distract the issue and give its advocates in the United States some ammunition. The currency's 50% undervalued, and letting it rise a few percentage points has no effect on trade.
And Morici says we should really just focus on China's trade policy. He says we should levy an across-the-board tariff on all imports from China.
All right. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reporting from Washington. Nancy, thanks.
You're welcome.
In the meantime, the Central Bank of Japan today intentionally weakened that country's currency, the yen, for the first time in 6 years. They sold yen and bought dollars. Japanese business leaders are applauding that move. The BBC's Rebecca Singer has more.
A strong currency may sound like a good thing, but it makes products sold abroad more expensive. Nintendo, for example, gets 3/4 of its sales from outside of Japan, and the strength of the yen can make its games less attractive to consumers in the US. And it's not alone. Well-known manufacturers like Sony, Canon, and Toyota are in the same boat. Now, Japan's finance minister, Yoshihiko Noda, has decided it's time to try and weaken the value of the currency by selling Japanese yen and buying US dollars.
We've just intervened in the currency market in order to avoid rapid exchange rate moves. We will take decisive steps if necessary, including intervention while continuing to closely watch currency market moves from now on.
It seems the Japanese Prime Minister feels more confident to take aggressive measures after fighting off a leadership challenge. The intervention caught traders by surprise, and the impact was immediately obvious. But Japan acted alone, without international cooperation from other central banks. And that means the effect may be short-lived. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
The World Trade Organization is set to rule on a complaint against American aircraft maker Boeing. The charge? That the U.S. government is illegally subsidizing the company and placing its rival, Europe's Airbus, at an unfair advantage. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from our London bureau with the latest. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So this complaint has been going on now for, what, 6 years? Why has it been dragging?
Yeah. It's very complex. You've got two major companies, and each has complained that the other is getting unfair state aid. Now, the WTO ruled earlier this year against Airbus. It agreed that Airbus had benefited from low interest rate loans from European governments. Today, the Europeans have their day in court. The WTO rules on the EU case against Boeing.
And do we have any indication, Stephen, as to how the WTO is going to rule?
Well, we won't know for sure until later today, but observers say the WTO is likely to rule that Boeing also received unfair aid in the shape of more than $20 billion in Department of Defense and NASA research subsidies. If correct, this means both sides have lost. Laurie Price, aviation analyst with consulting firm Mott MacDonald, says it's time for both the US and the EU to accept that in this business, some state aid is necessary.
This is an inevitable part of the levels of investment that are required to develop large-scale transport aircraft in the 21st century.
He says that aid should, of course, be open and above board and restricted to similar levels on both sides of the pond.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting from London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
A glossy new magazine hits the newsstand today, and it is in Russian. One of Moscow's richest men is behind the venture, but who's his audience? Marketplace's Eve Tro takes a look.
Russian billionaire Mikhail Prokhorov already sells his magazine in Moscow and London. It's full of celebrity interviews and expensive brands. It's called Snob. In Russian, Snob. That's Marketplace editor and Russian speaker Lisa Tucker. Now, who'd want to read something called Snob? According to their website,
требовательный, образованный и умный читатель.
In English, please?
Demanding, educated, and whip-smart readers, of course. They might buy all the same Mercedes and Prada everyone else does, but they think in Russian.
It is a niche within a niche.
Media analyst Ken Doctor says while the young Russian jet set is growing, magazine sales aren't Snob's goal. Publisher Mikhail Prokhorov bought the New Jersey Nets basketball team last year, and Doctor says Snob could help sell luxury boxes at NBA games.
Is there a commonality between the people buying Armani and Dior and Chanel and going to Nets games? I don't know.
If not, Prokhorov must be counting on Snob magazine to create that link. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, September 15th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, just go over to the numbers at marketplace.org. If you want to save some money, you could travel by bus instead of airplane, but look out for some hidden bus fees. In fact, here's your lookout man, Los Angeles Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. Hi, David.
Good morning.
I didn't know this. Greyhound charges a gift ticket fee?
You're online. You're buying your ticket. If you come across a thing that says, is the credit card holder doing the traveling? If you say yes, you're good. If you say no, for instance, if you're buying the ticket for a son, a daughter, a friend, they will slap that $18 fee on.
Why? How does it cost them more when I buy a ticket for someone else?
And that's sure a good question. And I sure put that to Greyhound. And here's their defense. They say, on the one hand, it's an anti-fraud fee. It helps to cover the expenses they face in not just protecting customers, but protecting the company from credit card fraud. Okay.
All right.
And then they also say it's a handling fee because whoever's actually doing the traveling has to actually, show up at a bus depot and pick up the tickets. You would think that's a service they've been providing since time immemorial. Then when you look closer, you see that this doesn't really stand up to scrutiny.
Why is that?
That's because the anti-fraud measure is being imposed willy-nilly. For example, if you say you're doing the traveling yourself, there is no fee attached. Well, wait a minute. Anyone using a credit card or buying online poses the same risk of fraud as anyone else. So why is it that some tickets face this anti-fraud charge and others don't? And then the handling charge, $18? Are you kidding me?
I'm always in the position of defending these fees to you, David. How about this? The fees don't have to literally reflect a new cost to the retailer. The model is you charge extra for anything out of the ordinary. That keeps your basic product free or cheap for everybody else.
Well, you could say that, but their website all but encourages you to lie because you come across the part where it says, is the credit card holder doing the traveling? Well, if you truthfully say, yes, it's me, great, you avoid the fee. But if you want to avoid the fee, what Greyhound says you should do is say you're doing the traveling, buy it, and then send the ticket
mail
to somebody
else.
Mail
it to the person who's traveling.
Exactly. But wait a minute. So they're telling you that you need to lie to avoid the fee. What kind of company does that?
One that just got talked about on the radio?
Okay, we'll give them that much.
David Lazarus, Los Angeles Times consumer columnist. Thank you.
Leave the driving to me.
So it turns out being fat and out of shape isn't just bad for your heart and for your pocketbook and for your medical bills. It's bad for the entire economy, costing hundreds of billions of dollars a year. That's according to a new study on America's growing obesity epidemic. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more.
With more than two-thirds of Americans tipping the scales as overweight or obese, the economic impact spreads well beyond medical costs. Worker productivity is also suffering, says Ross Hammond of the Brookings Institution.
Absenteeism and disability in the workforce, those could add up to as high as $66 billion a year.
There are environmental costs as well.
Much higher levels of fuel use for transporting heavier passengers, both on airlines and passenger vehicles.
And more greenhouse gases because the humans are bigger and we transport more food to feed them. They also generate more organic waste, but let's not go there first thing in the morning. There are solutions out there, says Matt Lerner of WalkScore, which ranks cities based on how easily you can get around.
People who live in walkable neighborhoods on average weigh 7 pounds less
than folks in neighborhoods where you have to drive to stock up on more chips and guacamole. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Shareholders for United and Continental Airlines meet this Friday. They will likely approve the merging of the two. If that happens, all those planes will get a redesign. It'll be United's name, but Continental's logo. And the old United U-shaped blue and red tulip logo, that'll go away forever. The decision to get rid of that logo has sparked an online protest among thousands of flyers loyal to United, which got reporter Sally Herships thinking about why some people get so attached to a brand.
Some people want to save the trees, other people whales. For Jerry Benzel, it's the United logo. Benzel is 30. He's a PhD student in poli-sci in Laguna Beach, California. He's also very unhappy. United is planning to put Continental's globe-shaped logo on its planes after their merger. So he joined a group on Facebook, Save the United Tulip.
It's sort of like someone you know getting a face transplant.
Creepy. Except a logo isn't a person. It's a corporate symbol.
But, you know, symbols have always been important. Nations have flags, religious symbols. What makes sense in this age where corporations, you know, have such a big presence in our lives that the symbol for that corporation begins to mean something.
And Benzel says it does mean something to him. He feels proud to be a customer. The airline is one of the country's oldest.
You know, I'm almost embarrassed to say it. It's almost like these warm, tingly emotions.
People get emotionally attached to brands. But why? To find out, I asked Tim Calkins. He teaches marketing at the Kellogg School of Management.
It's not just about a product. It's about a brand that has a role in my life and the associations around it.
Like the orange juice you had on your first day of school or the airline you flew on your honeymoon. If you pair a brand with an experience, even everyday products can take on a lot of meaning. But when consumers care, brands have to be careful. Calkins told me about one misstep when department store Macy's was buying up lots of small regional chains.
And in many markets, when they changed the branding to Macy's, the change was fine.
Macy's would gradually fade out the old name, while their own name slowly got bigger, until the retailer got to Chicago and the Windy City's beloved Marshall Fields. In September 2006, Macy's changed the signs overnight.
And even now, there's groups in Chicago that continue to protest that change.
Kalkin says there's a lesson here for United and other brands. Take it slow or run the risk of turning off loyal customers. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Cartoon Network Nicktoons is planning a new show whose characters started as commercials.
The cartoon is called Zevo 3, and the characters were created to market the Skechers line of shoes. The show's villain is Dr. Stanley K. Foote, also known as Stankfoot.
Oh, of course.
Nothing will go wrong, though I will personally remove your head from your body.
Oh, he sounds mean.
Yes, I think he is.
The advocacy group Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood has complained to the FCC that if Zevo 3 is allowed to air, it could pave the way for kids' shows that are essentially 30-minute commercials.
Yeah, unlike, say, the Care Bears and the Transformers.
Oh, I remember that.
Yes, I believe my mom had a Howdy Doody puppet, as a matter of fact. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.